Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
And thank you very much, Brian. That was the creator of the Brown Briefly, Brian Brown. Brian started the Briefly and brought his high standards of hosting an intelligent discussion of current events, always laced with humor and empathy. And Brian's central concept was less is more, more or less. And of course, he invariably always brought more. Let me introduce the Briefly's to you. And I'm not seeing Bruce. I can't remember if Bruce was going to be gone today or what. But I'll start with sitting here next to me in the Gene Bosch studio downtown Vachon as my airplane partner and fellow treetop aficionado, arbiter, mediator, two-time Fulbright scholar, high-end women's shoe salesman, that's the one I like the most, a Pinkerton guard for the Pan Am's first 747, I think it was in San Francisco.
It was.
Yeah, and a former tort law professor and Washington State Assistant Attorney General Craig Bellis. Wow. Good morning.
Good morning, Truman. Thank you for that introduction.
Wow.
Happy to be here. Is Bruce missing today? Kevin, do you know?
I don't know. Kevin's muted right now, but...
I'm sending out an urgent dispatch to the Guardians of the Galaxy Consortium to see whether or not Bruce is tied up in some mission that we don't know about.
We'll see.
Hopefully he can join us.
He did say something about being gone, but I didn't know if it was today or if it was next week. But anyway, zooming in from his home is the skipper of the Opus and the voice of Indivisible Vachon and the Vachon Climate Action Group, the Indefatigable. How about that?
Very good.
Yeah, defender of democracy who strives to create a livable planet overseen by a government that we can all appreciate or at least tolerate. Good morning, Kevin.
It's a pleasure to be here back on the fringes of civilization on Vachon Island, and very much looking forward to the show today.
All right, good. Well, I am Truman O'Brien. I'm a former Alaska Airlines captain, and I'm a Vachon Airport Commissioner, among other things. And I'm sitting here behind the big red switch on the panel at the Gene Bosch Broadcast Studio in beautiful downtown Vachon, and. Today is what we're euphemistically calling the Truman Show, since we don't have a guest today, and they all laid it upon me to bring us the MC this thing. So here I am. But before we get going on that, tell us about your past week here, Craig. Anything going on?
Well, all sorts of things. I'll lay off the one subject because I think you got a question for me on that one.
I do.
But this was, again, a music week.
Oh, yeah.
Concert in the park with the Locarno Band, which were fantastic. Like I've said, anytime you get a band that's got a fiddle, a trumpet, a trombone, horses, bass, lead guitar, great lead singer, boy, that was great, the concerts in the park. This coming Thursday, it's the Bowie. He's going to be here. Martin Pevier.
Oh. Yeah.
And then I saw Jenny Don't and the Spurs at Sugar Shack doing a little country. After that, they had the Lahaina fundraiser the next day.
Yeah.
I think it was almost
There were 10 bands.
There was 8 or 10, something like that. Good food. And I also caught the Oppenheimer movie. I found really, really well done. And surprised when it was over that it was almost 3 hours long.
It went that fast, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
So it was a very entertaining week. So enjoyed it.
Wow. Well, you were a busy guy. How about you, Kevin? Were you busy this week as well?
I was. I was busy out tromping through the Olympic National Park wilderness.
Oh, yeah, you said you were going to do that.
Yeah, it was really fantastic. Of course, the weather was quite spectacular. And even though as warm as it was over the last several days, the first night we woke with ice on our tent, rain covers on our tent.
Really?
We're debating about how it could have gotten that cold when it was in the 80s, you know, that, the day. But we were up at 5,000 feet, so, you know, mysterious things can happen sometimes. Pardon me?
Did you summit?
Well, we passed a lot of magnificent peaks. Our goal was not to summit anything, but just to do some traveling.
Ah.
So, for me, it was retracing, some steps that I'd made before. And, the real beauty is being able to really share the treasure of that wild beauty that's out there, you know, with friends. And to just spend time together, sitting there on a grassy knoll overlooking, you know, three major river drainages and four or five ranges of mountain peaks, and naming, you know, trying to name which one's which.
Oh, wow.
Places that we had summited in the past. And the five of us, we started out to, not everybody could make the entire trip, but it was very, really, very gratifying, you know, to have a chance to share that with good friends. So
how was it,
5 days we had.
How was the smoke? Do you have a bad smoke up there, or?
It was great for the first 2 days. The last 2 days, we definitely had signs of smoke, mountains disappearing off, you know, into the distance. I don't know, out in the core of the park, you know, how much smoke content we had, but yeah, we knew that we were in smoke area, so
yeah,
we tried to tune it down, but you know, the allure of the mountains is pretty hard to resist.
Yeah, for sure. We were up in the San Juans a number of years ago when they had the big smoke coming over from Eastern Washington, and it was really interesting. You could see it boiling over the Cascades as it came toward the San Juans. Mm-hmm. And it finally, I don't think it actually ever reached us. I mean, we kind of had the edge of it, but boy, it was spooky for sure.
Yeah. I will have to say that on our route included St. Peter's Gate, which is a spectacular notch in the eastern shoulder of Mount Stone.
Hmm.
And to get to St. Peter's Gate from our direction, you had to go through another notch, not quite as formidable. So we decided we would christen that St. Fred's Gate, just because we had the opportunity to do that. I don't think we're going to be submitting that, you know, to the National
park.
Geographic,
yeah.
You know, to get it named on the map. But it was a lot of fun to go back and check out, see how those places are looking today.
I'm not familiar with St. Fred.
No,
we thought it was, he's just so obscure, and the really obscure saints just never get anything named after them. So
that's right.
We're just going for it.
He's the patron saint of mountain notches.
I think we're talking out of our mouths here spontaneously. We had a good time with humor and beauty all at the same time.
So my week, I shared a couple of those events with Craig. We started out over at the pub and listening to Guido Perla, who played at intermission for when there was a trio. And one of the I looked up and they said it's a trio, and I said, but there are only two guys up there. And they said, yeah, the third guy is an AI guy. He's part of the computer. I said, oh, okay, well, that's whatever. But they were very good. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Guido was wonderful. Enjoyed that. And then we did head over to Sugar Shack and enjoy the, what was the name of the band? It was
Jenny Don't
and the Spurs. They were great. Gee whiz.
You got to say it with your Texas or Eastern Montana.
Jenny Don't.
Jenny don't.
All right, I can say that. Anyway, that was great. And then, of course, the Maui fundraiser was fantastic. I'm really anxious to hear how she did. I think there was a whole bunch of people showed up and a lot of really great food.
I think did our share of contributing with pina coladas.
Yeah, indeed. That was great. Okay, hey, so I did a little research on Today in History. I got a couple of interesting things. In 1787, John Fitch had a steamboat which completed its test several years before Fulton did. And I had to look up Fulton's Folly, of course. It was steamed up the Hudson on August 17th, just a few days earlier, 1807. So several years. Let's see. You have to do the math, Craig. I know you're.
Oh, you're asking me to do the math?
I know you're a math whiz. No, it looks like it's about.
Just estimated.
I'm going to say 17 years. No, a little more than that.
That's quite a while before.
That's 20. Almost 30 years before. Wow.
Significant.
Well, here's one for us. 1847 was the very first air raid in history. Austria launched a bunch of pilotless balloons against the Italian city of Venice. That was in 1849.
Yeah.
This one I liked. 1864 was the first Geneva Convention, which was adopted by 12 nations. And it was for the amelioration.
You can say
amelioration. There we go. Of the condition of wounded of armies in the field. Let's try that.
That's
again.
That's easy for you to say.
For the amelioration of condition of the wounded in armies of the, in the field. Whew! But that's what it was for. Yeah. The very first Geneva Convention.
Right. Very important.
Indeed.
Not abided by. No. Some recent countries.
Exactly. 1901, the Cadillac Motor Company was founded. And oddly enough, exactly 1 year later, in 1902, U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt became the first U.S. chief executive to ride in a car. And was it in a Cadillac? No, it wasn't. Believe it or not, it was an electric car. It was the Columbia Electric Victoria Phaeton. And like the Columbia models, like other Columbia models, the Victoria Phaeton had an external box for the driver, which is located in the rear of the car.
Like an old English carriage.
Exactly. In fact, it looked like a carriage. I saw pictures of it. And I love this, that a Secret Service detail rode bicycles, and there was actually a guy on a horse as well.
You know what brand bicycle they rode?
I don't know.
I do.
Do you?
Yeah.
What?
The same people who built the car.
Really?
Columbia.
No kidding.
Columbia bicycles, which are still made.
Probably
today.
Not an electric bicycle either.
No, not electric. No, no. That car, by the way, is very similar to plug-in hybrids today, except it didn't have an internal combustion engine. But the electric portion of it ran for about 30 miles.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, you're just full of information.
I'm kind of a gearhead.
I knew that. But that was, never mind. All right. So, hey, in 1945, the Vietnam conflict actually began when Ho Chi Minh led a successful coup. And so I read a little bit about him. It's kind of interesting. He was born with this other name, which I'm not going to try and pronounce. Mm. But he adopted Ho Chi Minh as his moniker,
right,
as it were. But anyway, so 1945, so they were at it for a while. Of course, the French came in
forever.
Not too long after that. And the conflict ended with their Dien Bình Phu, the big battle there.
Yeah, unfortunately, you got to spend some time over there.
I did. In beautiful Southeast Asia, as we call it. So on the local news front, one of the big events this weekend was Engel's Car Show, Craig's, which you participated in.
I did. I think I participated in every one of them. Paul Engel's calls this the 20th annual show. He missed one show during COVID, I think. And it was wonderful as usual. The weather was gorgeous. Lots of great cars. The one thing about the Engel's Car Show is that it is so Vashon. the rat rods, the cars that are in the beginning of their restoration or not to be restored at all. But there were some high performance cars. There was a McLaren, and there were lots of Corvettes and. And there was a Pantera, and lots of interesting stuff. A lot of friendly people, ran into people I haven't seen for quite a while, which is the great joy of that gathering.
I was going to say that's always the most.
Thank. Oh, and I'll give Paul a plug. Yeah, have you ever seen his little yellow Volkswagen Bug?
I have.
It's a dilly, isn't it?
Yes,
for sale.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. So if you're interested in buying this class, I think it's a pre, I think it's 65 or earlier or something. I can't remember. If you're you're interested in that kind of vehicle, check out Ingalls.
Hmm. Well, you know, I bought a brand new 1968 Volkswagen Beetle 1500 right off the showroom floor in Kaiserslautern, Germany in 1968. It was a brand new
1968 model. That would be the place to buy it.
It was. I can tell you that in those days, they were selling for around...
What year?
68.
68.
Yeah, I'm thinking they're around $2,700 or $2,800 in the States. I paid $1,700 for it.
Yeah.
Brand new on the showroom floor.
Yeah.
So you were stationed there at the time? Is that it,
Jeremy? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Because there was a, for, you know, I think they probably still happens. I haven't looked into it lately, but the idea to travel to Europe, buy a car, you know, arrange for the purchase of a vehicle, drive it around Europe, you know, for your vacation, ship it home, and you can have it here in our country at a lower cost than if you buy it here off the showroom floor.
Yeah. And not only that, but since I was in the military, I took a European out, and before I got out, I shipped it home with the military. Didn't cost me a dime. They shipped it home for me for free, which is pretty cool. That was the good news. The bad news is it went to Houston, Texas, or to Galveston, actually, and I had my father go down and pick up the car. And, of course, he drove big cars all his life, big old
automobiles. He hated it.
Oh, my gosh. He said, man, this thing is a roller skate. He just was really not happy about having to drive that darn thing. And also, they scratched it, and they dented it, and they stole my jack and my spare tire.
Oh, my.
Yeah, it was not a good experience. But anyway, I did get a great laugh.
Started out good, though, right?
Yeah, I started out great. Yeah, well, it was free. What do you want? All right, so on the local front, oh, darn it, I was sorry, Bruce isn't here. I wanted to ask him about the Virginia 5 cruise because I know he was. Do you know something about that, Kevin?
Well, I don't, but I do have confirmation back through the email historical log, and Bruce is traveling today. Anticipated his absence.
Yeah, okay. I thought that was the case. I couldn't remember.
I understand that was, again, once again, a great tour around the island with Bruce talking about a lot of the history there. And turns out that, you know, the engineer on that on that boat, the one that takes care of that. I can't remember what make of engine that thing is. Do you know?
I don't.
Do remember? It's a famous name for old engines.
Yeah.
Is a friend of ours. She's been the engineer on the Virginia 5 for years. A woman who graduated from the Merchant Marine Academy and enjoys doing that every year. She teamed up with my wife for a little while they were taking a break. So...
Well, yeah, did she step off and Bruce stepped on, I think, and took the tour around? Captain Joe's here right now. Captain Joe, you wouldn't happen to know what engine there's on the Virginia 5, would you? Kind of a famous engine.
I do. She's a triple expansion steam engine.
Triple expansion steam engine.
Reciprocating steam engine.
Okay, you don't know the name of the company
that
made it, do you?
Okay.
No.
It's quite an engine. There's no question.
Yeah. Oh, I can see where it would take an educated engineer.
Somebody's got to stand there and watch
it. To run the thing.
To the engine room and look at the builder's plate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But it is a lovely piece of very old and lovingly maintained machinery.
Right.
Yep.
And because she's an all wooden hull, she is operating under very stringent Coast Guard inspection.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He was saying that because she's a wooden hull, that she comes under some very stringent Coast Guard regulations. I would assume that to be the case. But, boy, what an interesting ship.
Last of the Mosquito Fleet.
Yeah, exactly. Wow.
We may bring the Mosquito Fleet back.
Boy, I'll tell you what.
We may need to bring it back.
Brings us back to the next topic here. And what I wrote was, the ferries. What, if anything, can be done? And, boy. Captain Joe, why don't you come over here and grab a mic here.
Can't hear you when you're over there.
Well,
we'll decide. We can always turn off the mic.
That's right. That's right. We can always turn you off. You know, that's it. That's the beauty of that one.
You're going to put me on green?
Yeah, I'll put you on green. Go ahead, Kevin.
So I had an interesting ferry experience that surprised me last night as I was coming home from the peninsula. We decided we were going to stop off for dinner and then I'd take whatever boat was next. So as we're leaving the restaurant in Union and got an hour before we get to the dock, we would have gotten to the dock about 8:30 or something. And I would have missed the 8:20. Actually, I think it was the 7:20. So we were leaving. We missed the 7:20. And the next boat was the 11:20 from Southwest of Vashon.
Whoa.
And I'm thinking, you know, I've seen it. You know, I thought maybe I'd be having to hang out for maybe an hour.
Yeah.
So, but fortunately, there was a boat from Southwest to Fauntleroy and then from Fauntleroy to Vashon.
Oh.
Interestingly, when I went up to say, okay, I want to go to Vashon, but I don't want to go on like the 11:20 boat.
Right.
And the person there taking the taking my money is like, well, that's the next boat. I said, but no. How about if I go to Fauntleroy and then Vashon? Just sell me a ticket to Fauntleroy. And they do.
Hmm.
And I'm stepping back from the window and they say, wait a minute. You're going to Vashon. You're going to have to pay to go to Vashon when you get to Fauntleroy. So I shouldn't be charging you you could go to Fauntleroy here, right? You don't want to go to Fauntleroy. So it turned out that they voided the initial sale of a ticket to me. And sure enough, I was just able to ride for free, right, over to Fauntleroy, and then did pay the $3 to get back to the island.
Wow, but, that's great. That's great.
There's always some kind of a solution.
Some workaround.
You have to find it sometimes.
So, Captain Joe, we ask you to...
This person said they never had ever had to think about this before. First time in their career experience with the WSF that somebody wanted to go to Vashon, but there was no boat, but there was a way to get there.
Oh, my gosh. I can't imagine that somebody wouldn't have thought of that earlier.
I was going to say, that's a dilemma people have to deal with quite often.
All the time.
Yeah.
So, Captain Joe, we were talking about the ferry debacles and whatever.
Yes.
What's your opinion of the... and remember that these seven words that you can't use on the radio. But
you'd have an opinion on this subject.
I lust in my black captain's soul to command the ferry system, and I have made an offer to do it for 6 months without any salary.
Wow.
And I would return it to them in a somewhat better condition. So my thinking about it has a couple of prongs to the trident.
Okay.
To the sailor's trident.
Yeah, exactly.
The first one is that it has systemic problems, serious systemic problems. And those would be best solved by thanking the incumbent director of the ferry system for her service and moving her on to some other employment.
Some greener pastures.
How polite that was.
To get her out of there because she... is a political appointee. She has no maritime experience, of which I'm aware. She certainly did not come up through the ferry system. And she has an attitude which has communicated itself down to the people who pay for the ferry system, which is you, Captain, and you, Counselor, and me, Captain. And that feeling is... communicated to us by the hypocritical business of asking us what we think about raising the ferry fares. So I can tell you what I think about that is when you provide us with the service which you are required to provide, then we can talk about a suitable level of funding to come from the fare system.
Exactly.
So... So my first feeling is that we would be best served by a replacement of the very head of the ferry system, who is not only an assistant secretary of transportation, but is also a director, and replace her with a person who is at least a sailor. Hopefully somebody who has come up through the ferry system, someone who understands how the unions work. The ferry system has, I believe, something like four or five unions with which they have to deal.
Wow.
And the And the idea that they are there to serve the people who must ride the ferry rather than all of us are there to serve them.
Them, exactly.
So those are my thinking about that. And it really gets down to firing that gal and getting somody in there who really knows what
the heck they're doing.
Yeah, right. And who really cares.
Right. My question, I know with the... you know, having dealt with the unions and, mm-hmm. and FAA regulations and all of those things, I know that in the airline industry anyway, that there are some pretty stringent requirements, federal requirements, and then there are some union requirements as well that affect this. One of the things that they're trying to do to ameliorate the problems with the airlines is to reduce the competence requirements, basically. The time, they're not going to get it passed. The union won't let them do it. But the government is trying to say, well, you don't need to have quite as much experience to fly. Do you see anything like that occurring with Coast Guard or with the training and the requirements for deckhands and that sort of thing?
I don't see that happening. I think that many people don't realize that the ferry system is indeed regulated by the Coast Guard, that all of the people who man the ferries are merchant mariners. The officers are licensed officers in the Coast Guard. And the people who direct the traffic, as ineptly as they may well do that, are actually seamen. They are certificated by the Coast Guard. They have to have a certain level of training, a certain level of experience. And their primary job is to make sure that all of us get into the life jackets and into the water safely should there be a collision or a grounding. You know that ferries in our jurisdiction, the ferries do not have sufficient lifeboat capacity to accommodate everybody. So it's all done by rafts and by life jackets. And the theory is that the ferries would sink slowly and in a very dignified way down into a shallow place from which everybody could be rescued. So
sounds like the Titanic all over again.
Well, right? Except that the Titanic sank in a huge yacht. In a very, very deep water.
Exactly, exactly.
So I do not see the Coast Guard changing or standing down any of their requirements for either training or for experience, and I certainly hope not. Those requirements have been developed over actually centuries, and we are part of an evolutionary business, the business of going to sea. Mm-hmm. So I hope and I see no evidence of it, and I would know because I track all of this in the professional maritime press, so yeah. I would know if that was going to happen.
Any change there, you know? And one of the things it gets me back to the airline business, flight attendants. You know, they're there to do a heck of a lot more than
yes.
serve you, you know, sodas. You know, their job is to get your fanny off the airplane safely, and people don't realize how important their job is and the training that they go through. I mean, it's really pretty extensive training.
Yes.
Kevin, you had a comment.
Well, I had 2 points, but the one that I wanted to comment on as a follow-on to that. As a former Boeing employee, we had the opportunity for the new airplanes to go test the evacuation time. And so basically you'd sit on the plane, and I never did this myself, but some kind of alarm would go off, right? Some timing thing, and then it was time to get up out of the seats, and the chutes would deploy, and those flight attendants, their job is to get people into that evacuation chute, and boom, boom, boom. And I'll tell you what, right, it's really critical to be able to meet the time requirements to evacuate the plane. So yeah, it's a big deal. But the question I had, Captain Joe, 6 months is what your tenure was forecast to be. I'm wondering if you need to recalibrate that time now that the system has sunk so low. I'm just curious what you think.
In other words, can you do it are you still going to be able to do it in 6 months, or do you think it's going to take longer to straighten it out?
I picked 6 months as sort of an arbitrary number. And I picked 6 months because many of my deployments, especially to the ice, were about 6 months long. And if I were to, if the governor were to say, Captain Joe, I accept your kind offer, if the governor were to do that, I would have had maybe 2 weeks of advance notice, and I would have written the op order for the operations order for the ferry system, the op plan. Actually, it would be a plan, not more than just an order for the ferry system, so that on the day in which I hold up my hand and took an oath of allegiance to the state of Washington, that the order would hit the ferry bridges that very afternoon, and yellow puddles would start forming up underneath people who are sitting at their desks at Coleman Dock.
Oh, yeah.
Because part of my concern, and now I'm getting just a little bit serious here, part of my concern is that one of the reasons why the ferry system is like it is that I'm absolutely convinced that all of those staff pukies who are at Coleman Dock do not get out, do not get out on the car decks, and do not get up on the bridges. The ship handling in a couple of the runs is absolutely appalling, and I just, a ferry's not a very complicated piece of gear, and the ship handling of them is not particularly difficult. Yes.
I did have a question about that. I recently had lunch with Guido Perla, who is a maritime engineer or a designer.
Yeah.
And one of the things he said is that the unions have made it so that they can only use the rudder and steering propellers. Where he had designed a pod system, propulsion system, and with that you could track directly into a dock, mm-hmm. no matter what the wind or the current was doing. Mm-hmm. But with this current system, it's quite complicated. But they said no, those captains don't know how to do that, how to use those pod systems. So we have to stick with the rudder and the props. Does that make any sense to you at all?
I'm not a great fan of any kind of pod arrangements, and I respect Guido and his work tremendously. But ferries are like icebreakers. They need to be strong. They need to be predictable. They need to be obedient. And whether you have a pod system or whether you have just a straight propeller and rudder system or whether you have thrusters, thwartships, thrusters. Mm-hmm. Whatever system you have, you then teach and train the people to handle the ships using that system, and then you just drive them right into those slots. It's not a huge and difficult problem.
Kevin.
Yeah, I did want to mention for any of our listeners who are wondering what a pod system is, according to the International Union of Marine Insurance, is one type of azimuth propulsion consisting of an integrated electric motor propeller unit mounted on the same shaft installed in a gondola under the stern of the ship. So hopefully I've clarified.
Yeah, well, that clarified it perfectly. Yeah,
I know exactly what that is.
Yeah,
and I have a real hard on about those things because we are putting two of them into this new icebreaker, where I suspect they'll get sheared off.
I would think.
In 20-foot ice going into McMurdo.
Well, but they are going to do. They're going to install.
That's
them
what on. They're looking at right now. I'm very much against that.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy! Hi, Susan. Susan McCain dropped in today as well.
Hi, guys.
Hey, what's up with you?
Well, I'm fascinated by this conversation.
Well, good.
And, I have a couple questions, if I may. One is.
Well, I'm okay, but I we've got a waving hand back there.
Okay, go ahead, Kevin.
Sorry.
Kevin, go ahead with yours.
Well, I was going to say that the my layman's understanding of a pod is essentially a propeller on an articulating, rotating device. So
perfect.
Instead of a propeller pushing water against a rudder, you can actually change the direction of the propeller, much like an outboard motor.
Exactly. There you go.
It works exactly like an outboard motor. That's right.
That's very good.
Has the same vulnerabilities, too.
I'm sure. Susan.
It's a little scary. Well, a couple of things. One is I heard that another ferry ran aground one of the Bainbridge ferries recently, and I wondered why. And then a recent Seattle Times article indicated that the majority of the boats in the ferry fleet are so old as to be getting to the point of death.
Would you like me to comment on the death of the death
so, well,
part?
Why did it run aground, if you have any notion of that? And how, when you talk about your redux of the ferry system, does it include ways or somebody who can build new ferries?
So age, especially in things like ferry boats, is not necessarily the terrible thing that we are being led to believe it is. Ferries have a very predictable life cycle. They go back and forth. They go out of one slip and into another. And they should last for a long, long time. Rhododendron came to us from Maryland, where she went back and forth between Annapolis and the eastern shore of Maryland. I rode in Rhododendron when she was named for an obscure Maryland governor. When I was a teenager during World War II, and she still could be working for us today. So age is not nearly as pernicious as we are being told it is. What is pernicious is if they're not being lovingly cared for during all of the time that they are in existence. So the big ferries like the Tacoma, those ships should run back and forth for a long, long time.
So that brings up the question, though, Captain Joe, what kind of care do you do with a ferry? I mean, what do you do to maintain it, to keep it?
The ferries are inspected every year by the Coast Guard. They have to be taken out of the water. And you get down underneath and you inspect everything. You inspect the whole boat. Mm-hmm. And ferries are legitimately called boats, by the way, no matter how big they are.
Right.
So they, and as part of this inspection, there are well-known places where corrosion is going to get started. You inspect those places and you replace the steel as it becomes necessary to replace it. The Issaquas, the six Issaquas, are a particularly interesting class because they were built out of crappy steel. Hmm. I can go in Issaqua and tell you exactly where she is within a month of where she is in her maintenance cycle by looking at the amount of running rust that she has running down her side, and in particular where the frames are welded to the skin of the ship. So the way you maintain it is that you do it very, very thoroughly. And when you find bad metal, you crop it out and you weld in new metal.
So you're talking about in the hull? Or
I'm talking about in the hull in particular, yes.
Really?
And you re-engine the boats when it is necessary to re-engine. When you get so many hours or years on engines that it's necessary to replace them. The Issaquas were built with a very dicey and dodgy control system on them, which was electrical and electronic. Ferries don't have to have all of that. All they have to have is being able to back down when their captain tells them to back down. So we're making a big thing out of a relatively simple problem. And then after I answer what you're about to ask me, I will answer Susan's question.
Go ahead.
About grounding.
Go ahead.
Groundings almost always happen because of inattention to duty by the bridge people. Rich Passage over on the Bainbridge side is a little tricky and it's a little bit narrow. There are places up in the British Columbia ferry system which are tricky and narrow, and they run very large boats up there and they run aground up there. we're talking about boats that have a lot of windage, which is the slab side. Mm-hmm. And when you have a crosswind, Captain, you know about this.
Very well.
When you get a crosswind or you get a current which is working in conjunction with that crosswind, then you are maybe making leeway more than...
Headway. Huh?
sometimes more than you're making headway. That's right. So you need to compensate for that. But the Coast Guard would not have allowed that route to be constructed if it were not possible to, by skillful ship handling. That's another area that I would be working on when I become the commander of the ferry system. So the answer to your question, I don't know about this particular newest grounding. I'd be very interested to know what happened there. But power failures are very uncommon. The route from the engines to the propellers is very, very reliable. It's almost always solid. Or electric drive. Electric drive ships are very, very reliable. When you have a power failure, they don't happen very often. That's why God created anchors.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to say. Well, didn't they have a power failure just recently, the one over on Bainbridge that ran aground?
I am not so sure about that. I haven't read that report.
Oh, okay. Kevin?
So I was curious about this notion of the ability to put the vessel where you want it to be, in other words, in the deep water, regardless of those other forces. So, Captain Joe, you know this very well, and many of our listeners probably do. There's a rule of, like, I call it a hierarchy of who has the right of way, you know, the rules, correct, the marine rules of the road.
Correct.
And they talk in the marine rules of the road about certain vessels are the stand on vessel, mm-hmm, meaning that they're going to do what they're going to do. And vessels that are, I think the words are, constrained in the ability to maneuver, mm-hmm, are given more grace.
Correct.
And some people that I've talked to have questioned whether a ferry boat would be considered a vessel that is constrained in its ability to maneuver. What do you think?
It depends on where the constraining takes place, Kevin. Sometimes, for example, if she's out in the middle between Fauntleroy and our ferry dock, and she's out in the middle, she is not constrained in her ability to maneuver. She's got lots of room. She can move around. The trick here is that her conning officer, who may or may not be her captain, but whoever is the conning officer at the time, has to be leading the ship way, way out. These are enormous pieces of steel. They do not steer around like your MG, if you were an MG owner. You need to be thinking about what is out ahead of you by 2,000 yards, 4,000 yards, 2 miles, and be thinking about how you're going to maneuver the ship to make sure that when you get into those places, that you are where you want to be and need to be. Where a ferry is constrained in her ability to maneuver is when she's going into, for example, Rich Passage, or when she's making her approach into one of the ferry slips. And the correct term for a dock for a ferry is indeed a ferry slip. So it depends on where it is. And the language of the rules to which you refer, Kevin, the rules of the road, the rules of the nautical road, are now enshrined in international law from the International Maritime Organization, but they go all the way back to the Phoenicians in the Mediterranean. So that's the beginning of nautical rules of the road.
I have two things to say about that. First of all, the very same thing applies to aircraft. Mm-hmm. You have to be way ahead of the airplane. Yep. Knowing what you're going to do way before you need to do it. And we used to jokingly, you know, on Alaska Airlines, there's an Eskimo painted on the tail. We used to lovingly say, oh, I'm just hanging with the Eskimo, which mm-hmm. means you're so far behind the airplane that, you know, you just got behind. And so you really need to get back up to speed. But the question that I had was, you were talking about controls and the such. Does the ferry system use I can't remember what you call it, but it's the clanging thing where the bridge lets the engine room know what they need to do, you know, forward, aft, all that kind of stuff.
Right. Not anymore.
Okay.
I was the captain of two Coast Guard cutters that had the bell and a jingle system.
Yeah.
But the ferry system no longer have that. They all have bridge control.
So they can actually control the throttle or the...
Not only can, but must.
Oh, okay.
They must control them from the bridge, which simplifies the ship handling. Mm-hmm. My Northwind, which was both very large and very heavy, had bridge controls. She had a very large rudder. She had very large propellers that were set wide apart so that there was a good twisting movement. Mm-hmm. So for a 10,000-ton ship, she was incredibly easy to manage and easy to handle. And I could and did put her into a lot of really... where I only had a few inches on either end to get her in and out.
Wow.
So that's why I know that these ferry captains can be taught, and not on simulators either. There are lots of simulators now, and I'm not a great fan of simulators. What I'm a great fan of is taking a ship out into a Pacific typhoon and handling it out there. But
oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think we'll skip that.
I want to skip
particular
that one.
Part. Yeah, Kevin, go ahead.
I do have to add one more comment to this notion of thinking ahead in your trajectory of travel. I worked for a short time on the International Space Station.
Mm.
And intriguing to me, the International Space Station is not a maneuverable craft by any means, but the ability to chart where meteors are in our solar system, and the notion that was some maneuverability of the International Space Station, and they were always tracking its trajectory through space, looking to see what type of objects were there that they may encounter and how large they were.
Whoa.
And if they were large enough to do damage, then they would actually be able to have some effect to maneuver slightly the orbit. But you can imagine how far ahead they have to plan. So this factor applies in all kinds of situations.
You know, Truman just talked about it briefly. With regards to flying airplanes, there's an expression, what's the most important thing to think about? And the answer is the next three things.
That's right.
Whatever they happen to be, you've got to be ready for them.
That's exactly right. I love that. That's exactly right.
I have just one comment, and that is that your discussion is making me very concerned about the notion that both the airlines, unions, and the ship unions or the Coast Guard unions are thinking about reducing the requirements for competency.
No.
They're not.
The unions are not. No, it's our politicians that are.
We'll put them on the airplanes with the undertrained pilots.
Exactly. Sure. No, the unions are adamantly against any of those changes.
Good news.
And Captain Joe, you can probably, this is probably true of the maritime industry as well, but I know that in the airline business, the unions, I mean, when you look at a checklist, an aircraft checklist, that thing was developed by the union, really, because they're the ones who made sure that all of those safety things were taken into account. I don't know if you use checklists on a ship or not, but that sort of thing apply.
Well, you certainly do use checklists on ships, but when Kevin is talking about the space station, the people that are in the space station, the commander of the space station has got to be thinking ahead for a long time and with many possible objects out there.
Yeah.
When you are taking a ship up Chesapeake Bay and you know that you've got 15 downbounds coming, this is the 15 that you're thinking ahead about, not the three that...
Exactly.
That counselor is talking about, but every single one of those 15 up there that's ahead of you is a threat, and sure. Or your friend, depending on how close it is. And in Chesapeake Bay, which is where one of the ever ships ran aground, in a place that I'm very familiar with because I was home ported in Chesapeake Bay in two of my ships.
Mm-hmm.
So So you are thinking ahead to that one that is closest to you, but you're also thinking ahead to that 15th one that's all the way up at the top of Craig Hill Reach.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's the same thing applies. Like I said, same thing applies with with fast moving aircraft. Of course, ours happens a little faster than yours, I suspect.
Yes,
but it's the same process.
That's why you have positive control in your air traffic control system,
exactly. Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the vessel traffic service that we have here in Puget Sound, and the only time that the controllers on watch interfere in the safe navigation of ships is when they see a situation that they think that the ship captains and pilots cannot see.
Right, right. Which is very much the case with airlines as well. Yeah, for sure. Well, not to get too far afield here. Thank you very, very much, Captain Joe, for sitting in with us on this kind of unplanned unplanned itinerary here. But this was very, very helpful and very interesting. I really appreciate your insights. I think it's fantastic. And while we're talking to Captain Joe and to Susan, I need to put in a plug for their show coming up. They're going to have a combined show. It's a real talk from the captain's chair, as I understand you're calling it. Is that right, Susan?
That's right.
Yeah. So it's going to be starting, in fact, right after our show. We're going to have to do a little hot mic swap here. It'll be kind of interesting to see if we can get this
a
done.
A little bit of techno action.
Techno action and maneuverability. Speaking of planning ahead and thinking ahead, we're going to have to be doing that here shortly. But not to go too far afield, but one of the things I wanted to talk about before we get off our local subject is that Zero Waste Vashon has a program they're calling Choose Plastic Free, where they're focusing for the next couple of months on plastic packaging in particular. And my question for the group is, what are your opinions? Do you think we can actually do it? And what can we as individuals do? By the way, Americans produce about 500 pounds of plastic a year each. So that's the big push. So what do you think? I think they should rename it disposable plastics, because there's so many things that we have that are plastic that are not disposable. I mean, things that we use, tools and things that we use. But I think they're really concentrating on the disposable stuff, right?
You know, Steve Bergman, who is pretty knowledgeable about all this stuff, says there are good plastics and bad plastics.
Oh.
And the bad plastics are basically the single-use plastics.
Exactly.
And the good plastics are the ones that we use and use and use, that we make tools and containers and so forth out of that are reused.
Right.
So.
Okay. So what do you think, Craig?
I think we have to. Can we? Sure, we can. As a culture, as a society, you know, can we? That's another good question. But I think we do have to. I think that we meet with limited success in recycling plastic, so that you've got to reduce it in the first instance. And it does seem, I've said this before, it does seem absurd that you need the jaws of life to open up some of the plastic packaging that you get from Costco and other places.
Unbelievable.
And then there's this tiny little thing in there or something. It's obscene.
It is. It's ridiculous.
And so much of that plastic, whether it's attempted to be recycled or not, ends up back in the environment, in our blood systems, in the oceans, in our waters, everywhere.
So one of the things that, you know, just to go back to the ferries just for a second, one of the things that we talk about is that if you were in Eastern Washington and you were on I-90 and all of a sudden they stopped all the traffic and said, sorry, you're going to have to wait here for 4 hours because we don't have anybody directing traffic down the line here. And so you just have to sit here. You know, as they've heard, they would probably get that problem fixed in about 30 seconds because the way it impacts. And I'm thinking the same with plastics. I can't imagine that we can't come up with a biodegradable or a plastic that either biodegrades or has something that will eat it. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, a lot of the blister packs that Craig is talking about, I suspect were created because it's easy to market and show off the product. Mm-hmm. You know, you could put it in a cardboard box, right, which is very recyclable. But the notion that climate issues can be influenced by consumer choice is something that is really far-ranging. So the notion of I'm going to select a product that doesn't have plastic, which is a petrochemical, but you know, product, and requires us to extract, you know, petroleum products out of the ground to produce, mm-hmm. much less the waste stream. But it goes beyond that. It goes beyond, you know, you're shopping at Thriftway and there's the range of apples. And, you know, some of those apples came from New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And New Zealand's a wonderful place. But, you know, that apple has a lot of airtime and a lot of carbon pollution behind it to get here. So consumer choices can be very effective. They're not immediate. But I think that in the long run, it's one of the really most powerful tools we might have to address some of the climate issues we're facing.
And I would specifically relate that to the United States, yes. not necessarily to the world, but to the U.S. in general.
We are, if not the biggest consumers on the planet, and we're the problem.
We need, they say, an Earth and a half. If everybody in the world consumed the way we did, we would need more than the amount of surface that we have on the face of the Earth.
You know, that's such an important point, Craig. And we have set the example for consumerism, for what is supposedly a good upper middle class life. Now I think we need to set the example for, let's put on the brakes on consumerism. We need to be the leaders. That's such an important point.
Which is huge, huge.
I want to get all of the plastic out of the Pacific Ocean. All of that is floating around out there in that great big mass of...
Plastic island.
Plastic, yes. Yeah.
What do they call it, a gear or a...
A weir.
A weir, is that it? Yeah. Okay, folks, well, you know, we've got about 2 minutes left here. I do have an
announcement, if we have a moment.
Yes, we do, and that was what I was waiting for. Go ahead.
Okay, fantastic. Thanks for that opportunity. I do want to make sure that our listeners are aware that upcoming, the Vashon Mori Community Council is planning a candidate forum for any of the ballot items in our election coming up. Those that are being competed by more than one person, so there's an actual opportunity to hear from two candidates. The candidate forum is planned for the 21st of September from 7 to 9 p.m. It's actually going to be a Vashon Mori Community Council meeting, most of which will contain a discussion from the candidates, about 7 or 8 minutes of questions per candidate per race at the Presbyterian Church. So put that on your calendars. Check out the vmcc.org website for more details.
And, yeah, all right.
You can attend.
Thank you for that. We very much appreciate that. Captain Joe, did you want something, say something?
I was just reading.
Oh, okay. Okay, never mind.
And I agree.
Oh, all right. I want to say that next week for the next edition of the Brown Briefly, Craig's going to be sitting in behind the big red switch here running things since I'm going to be gone. I'll be heading down to Southern Oregon for a week to sample some of their smoke. That's just slightly different from the smoke that we have here in our area. But next week's show is going to be, the guest will be Keith Pryor, and he'll be discussing the Great Burton Gooey Duck Contest. I'm not sure what that is, but it sounds pretty darn fascinating to me. So anyway, from Kevin and Craig and myself, Truman, we certainly appreciate you joining us today, and they will see you next week. And stick around for the extended show of Real Talk and the From the Captain's Chair.